Mammoth
Audio. This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. Film noir, with its double-dealing, morally ambiguous characters and dark, twisted storylines, is perfect for capturing swindlers and their motivations. Today, we're going to examine perhaps the greatest film noir con artist movie of all time, Nightmare Alley. My guest is author Simon Caterson, and this is Scammapalooza. Whenever I think of film noir, I always feel like film noir are the movies in which two spies have to meet in a cinema and one of them's sitting and then the other slowly comes in and sits in the row behind and they have a clandestine conversation. And film noir is the film which is playing on the screen during that.
Well, of course, it's a mood, it's an atmosphere, it's a style. And so it's, I think it is conducive to deceit and because, you know, there's so often there are characters pretending to be somebody else or there are characters, you know, carrying sort of psychological burdens of one sort or another who are confused about themselves. The city, because it is an urban-based genre, although, of course, there are some noirs set outside the city, but nevertheless, you associate it with the urban spaces where places of anxiety. And so naturally, you're going to get people preying on each other, exploiting each other, taking advantage of each other. Possibly the greatest of all of those examples of in the film noir genre is Nightmare Alley. Just so dark.
So incredibly dark. It surprisingly for a film based on a book of that era, rather than making it a little bit friendlier or simplifying it, it seems to keep very much with the darkness of the novel. It doesn't pull a lot of punches, and it doesn't keep away from the themes of the book. I think maybe we should give listeners a quick overview of the book and the movie. So it's the story of the great Stanton, played by Tyrone Power, and he is a carnival barker who makes his way up through the ranks of the carnival and then into the semi-legitimate theatre as a supposed psychic and mentalist, when in fact he's a fraud using the skills that he's learnt from the various people that he's betrayed along the way. And the movie opens with him looking at the geek in the sideshow in the carnival, and the geek being, of course, the supposed wild man who has gone off the deep end and bites the heads off live chickens for the entertainment of the punters. And he wonders what could ever make a man do that? What, how low would you have to sink in order to be someone who does that for a living? And that is something that this character of the geek who you barely see in the movie. He's sort of, you hear his cries, you see him running around in the background of a couple of scenes. But aside from that, he's a very, very small role. And yet, He's there as sort of a threat throughout the movie of this is what happens when life goes wrong.
Of course, it's done in that, like you say, in that oblique sort of film noir style with light and shadow, which makes it all the more terrifying, really, because it's not shown. And of course, it's Tyrone Power, who, back in the golden age of Hollywood, was one of the most dashing, romantic leading men, a bit like Errol Flynn, but without the twinkle in his eye, sort of thing. He was a sort of clean cut sort of guy. But for him to be playing that role makes it even more fraught and interesting for the viewer, and I suppose a brave move on the part of the actor at that in that era. Of course, film noir was an almost accidental genre. Nobody who was involved thought they were making film noir. It was only later discovered by French critics who gave it a French name. These were just the post-war films that were being made, mystery thrillers, or no one had a sense of that there was some deeper existential angst being expressed in these films. A lot of the filmmakers were influenced by German expressionism and through the use of black and white and high contrast and the themes that they explore as well of psychic disturbance. And
but in this movie, I mean, it's a very real sense of psychic disturbance in that you have characters who are con artists who are pretending that they can read minds and pretending that they can predict the future and using that for their own financial gain. And yet at the same time, there's this undertone of, and it's never sort of explicitly said, that perhaps there really is a hint of the supernatural. So you have Mademoiselle Zina, who is the great Stanton's mentor and would-be lover at the beginning of the film. She's clearly performing a fraud. She's asking people to write down questions on pieces of paper, which are then swapped for identical slips, and the identical slips are burnt. Meanwhile, her alcoholic husband Pete is underneath the stage, writing out the questions on a chalkboard and holding them up for her to see through a hole in the table, so she can look into her crystal ball and see these questions she should supposedly have no way of answering. And yet, in the very next scene, you see her in a hotel room pulling out the tarot cards, or she calls them tarot cards, and doing a tarot reading, and taking it very, very seriously, herself. And, yes. And so there's this sense of underneath that perhaps they're really, you know, these people who are defrauding, the general public, but every now and again will pull out these tiny little miracles. You know, the fate of Pete gets predicted by the tarot cards, and the great Stanton is correct in his predictions on more than one occasion. And that's something you see in film noir, that kind of that hint of the hint of the supernatural.
Well, and, Cornell Woolrich in particular, this was his thing, the ineffable sort of things in life, presented in a kind of, you know, almost a horror, you know, psychological intensity that he achieved. This was very much his thing. And, I think that, within film noir, you will accept an awful lot. It's the case that, your worst fears are likely to be realized.
Because every character seems to has something which they are dreading happening to them. So for Stanton, it's the geek ending up like that. And for Xena, you know, it's to do with her regrets with her husband. And even the strong man is terrified that he's going to lose the girl that he loves to Stanton. And, you know, a lot of those things come true. A lot of people's worst fears are realized, often because they, them trying to avoid that from happening. They seem to come true. It's surprising that most of these films were made during the Motion Picture Production Code, when they were supposedly cracking down on sex and violence and impure images in film.
On the contrary, I think, well, they were, but the movies of the golden age of 40s and 50s are some of the sexiest, most deviant movies of all time, simply because the writers and directors were finding very interesting ways to get around the literal-minded code of morals. Of course, prior to the production code, you had quite explicit depictions, nudity, language, etc., alcoholism, all decadent behavior, which we, in our historical imagination, associate very much with the 20s now anyway. And then things apparently became more puritanical, but in fact, there's a lot of sex in film noir and in the movies of that period. And, I'm sure the audience has recognized it, and, it's there for us to enjoy now. You know, it's a sophisticated, pleasure
to sort of look closely to see what's going on under the surface, which of course is a theme throughout, you know, the con artist cinema, is that what you're seeing in front of you is not always what is really going on. And while this film doesn't necessarily have a twist in the end, it certainly has plot twists and various, you know, narrative bends and turns. There are things which surprise you as it goes on in that grand tradition. I'm also fascinated by the way in which the film begins looking at psychics and psychic frauds, and then neatly segues into talking about psychology. And psychologists and the way in which they operate, as if the director is trying to draw a comparison between what psychologists do, which is talk to people about their problems, and what a fake psychic does, which is talk to people about their problems. And so they introduce halfway through, the great Stanton appears to meet his match in the form of Lilith, who is a whip smart psychologist who instantly sees through his act. And he meets with her and discovers that she is in possession of a lot of private and secret information about various members of the city. And Stanton sort of decides that that information would be very, very useful for him. And her meetings with clients, particularly with the elderly woman whose name I've completely forgotten. It's Mrs. Peabody, I think it is. Mrs. Peabody, who is desperately trying to contact either psychologically or spiritually her departed daughter. And both Stanton and Lilith are offering their own sort of way of coming to terms with that death. He doesn't seem to have the film doesn't seem to have a lot nice to say about psychology.
No, and it's interesting that again in film noir, but also more generally, psychoanalysis is a big preoccupation. Freud was just being universalized in throughout American society. The idea of psychoanalysis was being taken on board. Particularly as I read the history, by the American military, because they had so many, ex-soldiers who, and again, these are often the typical noir protagonists, a returned soldier who's damaged by the experience, by the trauma of war. And, America was full of, you know, millions of people like this. And Freud, largely through the promotion of his nephew, Edouard Bernays, who is credited as being the father of publicity movement in America. This was something that was spreading like wildfire throughout society. So it's no wonder that screenwriters and directors were picking up on this. Of course, you know, Hitchcock was very influenced by Freud, and so you get a lot of that preoccupation, and you know, is it science? Is it a con? These debates go on now. If you talk to Scientologists, they'll tell you that psychiatry in particular is an evil science, non-science. But yeah, it depends who you talk to.
It's interesting you bring up the Scientologists, because there is that sense throughout the film of characters playing God, of being seeing themselves as the controllers of life and death, and as the being responsible for the course of fate. And both the psychologist and the fraudulent psychic are both guilty of doing that, of trying to sort of pull the strings on people. So I think in that sense, the Scientologist would probably get a lot of joy out of this film, I would imagine.
having the ability to manipulate people probably does give you it's hubris, you know, being able to successfully change people's behavior or make them do what you want to do. It must be a thrill. It must be powerful for those who enjoy that, doing that. And as well as profitable. So, it's a sort of the seductive aspect for the person doing the manipulating. But of course, you know, humans always are the most deceptive and the most suggestible species. So it's no wonder that if you like, the hunter becomes the hunted, that you can overlook your own susceptibility to being conned. At the same time, you know, so nobody's in complete control. That's what makes our life so interesting.
Yeah, I think in terms of that seduction, the viewer is very easily seduced to side with Stanton and to agree with what he's doing and to not question his actions and his behavior. Firstly, I think because he's played by Tyrone Power.
Indeed.
Who is extraordinarily charismatic and at the height of his sexual prowess on the screen. The death of Pete, which happens quite early on, where he goes to give Pete a bottle of moonshine and accidentally, well, again, it's unclear, supposedly accidentally gives him a bottle of rubbing alcohol, causing him to poison. Pete gets poisoned and dies. You instantly feel not for Pete, who's just been killed, or Zena, who's just lost her husband, but you feel for Stanton, who has committed this great error. And the camera follows Stanton as he slowly walks over to the prop box, where the bottle of, rubbing alcohol is supposed to be, and opens it up very, very slowly and takes out the bottle of moonshine and realizes what he's done. And we follow him as he goes and hides the bottle. And we as the viewer feel for him, or extraordinary, you know, we feel bad for him, despite the fact he's now hiding the bottle of moonshine and hiding his crime. And it's the sign of a good con artist, is when even when you see them do something morally dubious, you still stay with them, you still accept their behavior.
Oh, well, you know, hence the success of, you know, people like, I suppose, L. Ron Hubbard and others, you know, who...
Sorry, just to be clear, you're suggesting that L. Ron Hubbard is a con artist?
I'm suggesting that he's someone who has a lot of admirers.
Backpedaling, back you go.
I've just seen that the reason he's on my mind, I suppose, is not because I'm a Scientologist, but because I've seen that Going Clear.
Oh, yeah.
And you get the sense there that the charisma, you know, charisma goes a long way. And it may be a strange charisma, like it's not something you personally feel, but you sense that other people feel it, and it makes them do all kinds of things which they may, well, as the film suggests, may deeply regret later on when they've awoken from this sort of trance that they've been put into. I think it's the same. You know, all of us want to believe in something bigger than ourselves.
Mm.
And it is, we want to submit in some way. I think we want to have all our questions answered. We want to have a clear explanation, whether it be, and it could be, you know, in the cards, it could be the daily horoscope. It, and if you have someone like, Tyrone Power, I mean, he was such a luminous screen presence. I think if it was, a more roguish leading man like Errol Flynn, you might not, well, unless you're a certain kind of impressionable female cinema goer, you might be a little, but Tyrone Power just seems such a clean cut. So it was, again, a very interesting casting choice, for the film. And it's really, I think, a large part of the explanation why it is such a great film is because of that choice. And again, you know, you're dealing with star power. You know, the film is, it's not a film within a film or a dream within a dream, as so often film noir is, particularly the Cornell Woolrich derived screenplays are. But it is, you are seeing a film made in that as part of that star system. You're aware of the film as a film at one level with Tyrone Power, the big name star, but at the same time it's a story in which he's playing a very being cast against type, as it were.
Yeah, and there's nothing really in. I mean, if you had seen it, to be honest, it reminds me a lot of the films Robin Williams made in the late 90s, early 2000s, when, you know, after 20 odd years of making either slapstick comedies or you know, sincere dramas, he suddenly decided to make very sinister, play very sinister, sometimes evil characters, like Death to Smoochie, One Hour Photo.
One Hour Photo, yeah.
Is of course the one, and Insomnia. You, as a viewer, the baggage that comes with seeing Robin Williams suddenly playing someone so evil makes those films great. And same with Tyrone Power. I'd imagine if you just knew him as the dashing leading man, and suddenly, and the poster gives nothing away, really. It's his face with a cigarette in the corner of his mouth, looking suave and debonair as always, and a, you know, cavalcade of beautiful women around him. I can imagine a lot of people went to see this movie and came away, you know, quite disturbed by what they saw.
Yes. I don't know whether it was a box. It did good business in its time, but you know, perhaps it was one of those decisions, you know, do you make films for the money or for the art? And perhaps that was the decision that was made, or perhaps the studio had nothing else for him to do at that moment. They like to keep their contract players busy. Perhaps his star was on the wane by then. I'm not sure, but
I think it was he wanted to do something a bit different, and so even if the studio didn't want to, I imagine they would have, you know, given him that leeway. If he was, you know, if he had the ability.
Another good example, I think, is Peter Sellers in Being There.
Yes.
Where he, after a long career, a very successful career of, you know, playing outrageous comic characters, in his just about his last film, played a character with no character, no personality, and was devastating in that. And that is, you know, extraordinary performance. So
I've just looked it up in my memory. No, I've just looked it up, and Nightmare Alley did not fare well at the box office and was quickly forgotten, and has only been sort of rediscovered in sort of the era of home movies, when people can suddenly re-explore all these classic movies.
And film noir itself, of course, is so popular now. It's such a genre that doesn't really date.
No.
In the same way, as musicals, although a lot of people love musicals but also comedy doesn't really survive as well.
Mm.
But because film noir is so serious and is so intense, has an edge to it, I guess. It shows people being genuinely nasty to each other. And sometimes, as in this film, unleavened, you know, sort of a harsh reality for all that it's stylized, might well perhaps be the most watched Tyrone Power film nowadays. Maybe except for one or two of the pirate ones, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I can't think of one off the top of my head that would have the same reach as this, and certainly that people are still talking about in that sense. Yeah. We should have a look at some of the other film noir films of the era that sort of dip into the world of the con artist. For me, and I'm not sure if you've seen this one, but the Confidence Girl is also film noir, and it also deals with fake psychics, but it is a lot lighter, mm-hmm. and feels more like a romantic film than it does strictly crime.
So is it a women's picture? Or
a women's picture.
As they were called then.
I think it certainly was aiming to bring women in and for women to associate with the lead character. It's essentially the story of a fake psychic and her husband, and the fake psychic wants to give up their life of crime and settle down and marry. And of course there's a scene in which they're in somebody's house where they shouldn't be, having dinner and faking having a normal married life, and she's basically begging him, come on, let's give this up and become honest, decent people. And he's saying, no, just one more score. And they have it similar to in Nightmare Alley. They have a nightclub act in which they reveal personal information about the various people. In Nightmare Alley, they have a secret code which is used to communicate between the husband and wife, and of course the psychologist feeding them information. In Confidence Girl, they have the much less believable idea of little holes drilled in the roof and a whole team of people in the room above looking down with telescopes and binoculars to gather various bits of information from people and eavesdrop on their conversations, and that information is fed back to them. And spoiler alert, in the film's conclusion, the psychics overhear that a man is about to be murdered, and they have to, and the police are there investigating them, and they're in the audience, and the psychic, the woman is trying to convince the police, someone's about to be murdered. I've seen this. I've had this vision, and the police don't believe her because she is a fake psychic, and they don't believe a word of it. And, she has to make the decision. Do I admit that I'm a fraud and I've overheard this information and go to prison, or do I let this innocent man who's about to be murdered be killed?
Mm.
And she does the right thing. She admits that it's all a fraud. I overheard the information. I'm not really psychic. You have to do something. And then the police admit that it was just a sting operation in order to get her to confess. And of course they go to prison, but she goes to prison, redeemed.
With her head held high.
With her head held high. So there's a sense of, you know, there's still the moral ambiguity there that you see in these types of movies, but there's redemption. And that's, I think, what people want from, that's, I think, what people always want from their villains, particularly those who are ambiguous. They want them to be redeemed in some way, even if that means they go to prison or they die or something happens. They want that sense of redemption. They don't want the criminal to keep on, committing their crimes.
And, yeah. Although, hearing about that film reminds me of a non-film noir movie, which is kind of, there's a certain parallel, and that of course is The Lady Eve, Preston Sturges.
Yeah, well, it's a con artist movie.
Yes. It doesn't fit within the and in fact it is a comedy where the humor is still present, you know, we can still relate to it.
Mm.
But you kind of don't want her to be a good girl,
no.
The Barbara Stanwyck character, and in fact you do identify with her. Of course the Henry Fonda character is such a pale sort of, he's a nice guy, but he's ripe for exploitation, shall we say.
Yeah. But essentially the simple version of the story of Lady Eve is that, Barbara Stanwyck plays a card shark, a swindler, a con artist, and Henry Fonda is sort of a victim of sorts. And she, essentially they spend the film circling one another and her using her powers of impersonation and con artistry to essentially to seduce him and to win him over using the only skills that she has. And although she gets away with it, in inverted commas, there is still that sense of redemption and of the kind of the shrew is tamed a little bit in that she gets what she wants, which is the man in the end. But there is always that idea in these films of the woman who has gone down the wrong track, but all she's got to do is marry and she'll be okay. If we can just marry her off to the right man, she'll be, That's the same as going to prison in the end of the movie. It's not necessarily a negative thing, but it's still a redemption of sorts. It's that idea of, you know, the marriage is in these movies is always seen as a way of solving conflict and of wrapping up loose ends.
Yeah. It's of course, you know, in real life, it's the beginning of another story or the continuation of the story rather than the end, but you can't make films that go on forever. But also, a lot of these films that are about con artistry, and particularly when there's a sexual element, are metaphors for relationships. Mm. You know, and again, it's part of human life that people strive to be something more or something other than they believe they are. We have a kind of a secret knowledge of ourselves and other people, which we never talk about. With them. So I think it's a very interesting, there's a limit to how much you can judge people. And she's very clever and she's fabulous legs and, you know, which she uses very effectively. You kind of get seduced along, with the Henry Fonda character. You're a bit more self-aware than he is.
Yes. Well, he can't spot the fact that this woman, these two separate women are in fact the same woman, despite her not really using any sorts of disguises at all. She's just, well, she's in a different location, has a different name. Therefore, I'll just accept that she's a completely different person.
Well, he's interested in, from memory, jungle wildlife and stuff. You know, he's not really, humans are not really his special subject. So, of course, at the, famously the opening credits, the opening title sequence, in the film is, a replay of Adam and Eve and the serpent and so on. So that gives you an idea of the mythological or religious basis for this, story, but again, there are a lot of romantic comedies that feature people, you know, deceiving each other or deceiving people for a good cause, which is the course of true love, you know.
One that I think flips that on its head is Bedtime Story. Which, have you seen Bedtime Story?
Yes.
The original Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Because Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is essentially a soft remake of Bedtime Story, which is a horrible, it's a nasty little film. So in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, you have, two suave con artists of very different styles, essentially trying to, firstly to try and swindle a woman out of her money, but then try and swindle a woman into falling in love with either of them. And of course, in the end, she manages to pull the rug out from both of them and turns out she's a greater con artist than either of them, which is a nice way of dealing with what could have been a fairly grotty film. In the original, the woman is the victim the whole way through the movie, and it's Marlon Brando and David Niven. And in the film's conclusion, David Niven tricks Marlon Brando into marrying the woman. And so this man who is a playboy and doesn't want to settle down and is very misogynistic, clearly does not like women and spends the movie trying to punish them for being women, is forced into marriage.
And also, what a choice, you know, David Niven and Marlon Brando. I mean, you know, I think you'd kind of tend to go for one type rather than the other. I didn't know that you'd see them as a natural alternatives, but
yeah.
There were so many films being made during the the golden age of Hollywood, that not only were there many bad ones, but there were many sort of strange ones as well. And I think that's one of them that has a more pessimistic outcome than you'd ever expect. It's a harsher film than the remake, funnily enough, which tends towards caricature, I think. I think it's a bit hammy by comparison.
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yeah.
Well, the fact they turned it into a musical. As soon as you turn a film into a musical, it makes you look at the original film in new ways. Yeah. So speaking of women, let's have a look at the women in Nightmare Alley. You essentially have three different women in Stan's life. You have Xena, who is older than him. She looks probably mid-40s, I think. And she has a long history as a psychic. And she's both his mentor, but also he very much runs rings around her and emotionally manipulates her and is very much in control, despite the fact that she's the one who's taught him literally everything he knows. Teaches him to be a carnival barker, teaches him the secret code, makes him the man that he's going to be. It could be very easy to see her as a weak character and as a woman who doesn't have a lot of inner strength and doesn't have a lot to, you know, like so many of the women in those films, that a piece to be moved around the chessboard, or a prize to be won or lost. But you're very sympathetic towards her, despite the fact that she's a con artist herself.
Indeed. Well, it's all about contrast. I mean, she's not a femme fatale.
No.
She's in the trade. She's working the angles, but she's a pretty straight person. She's not her deviousness is of the honest sort.
Yeah. She saves her deviousness for on stage.
Yes.
And she has honor in sticking with Pete, because she wronged Pete in the past. And even though he's an alcoholic and is ruining her career, she's going to stay with him. And so there's an honor there. Molly, on the other hand, is an innocent. And Molly is the young carnival girl who Stanton ends up eloping with and leaving Xena behind. And the two of them have success on the stage. She's a much more traditional love interest, in that I think at one point she says, when they finally marry, he says, "I'll make you so happy. I'll be everything you want in a wife and whatever you want." And she's very much a pushover, as a character and very forgettable, despite being, the youngest and most attractive of the women in the film. She's very much, not an interesting character.
Well, she's much more of what you were saying, the sort of pawn on the chessboard. And again, these characters are paired, and also, well, in this case, there are three main female characters, and, both of the two that you've mentioned already provide a contrast to the third one, who is a kind of evil genius, very controlled, a very, manipulative, woman by comparison, and quite formidable.
Yeah. So Lilith is the psychologist who we mentioned before, who not only figures out what the great Stanton is doing, but begins to manipulate him. And it's really the first time you see him properly manipulated and properly on the ropes is when she arrives. Did you know she, the first time she's introduced, she's dressed in, a beautiful gown, and she looks like a beautiful woman. But then the rest of the movie, she's mostly dressed in very masculine wear. She's presented as she's wearing a pantsuit when they meet in the psychologist's office, and her, aside from her depiction as a potential romantic or at the very least sexual partner for the Stanton, her role is very masculine for a film of that time, that she's a doctor, and she's a villain, but she's a villain, and although she's depicted as a femme fatale, she doesn't use her sexuality in the way that a femme fatale normally does. She outsmarts the great Stanton for her own ends.
And again, this is something that an aspect of the film which makes it so watchable now is that she doesn't fit any particular stereotype that we stereotypical character that we associate with films of that era. She seems timeless in that sense. You could easily imagine a character like that in a contemporary remake of the film, for all that other aspects of it seem anachronistic.
Well, there is a similar character in David Mamet's House of Games.
Indeed.
And she is a psychologist, and she is sort of introduced to the world of the con artist, and there is that link between the world of the con artist and the world of the psychologist. And although she's much more of, you know, although she becomes a victim of a sort throughout the movie, there is that idea of her being very much the protagonist and very much the one person who could possibly beat the con artists at their own games is someone who understands the human mind.
Yes. Well, when you were mentioning about the conned being the con artist, I thought of Mamet. Mm. I thought of that, you know, the layers of complexity of conning that, people who appear to be victims are in fact just smarter, better at the game.
Can we, I just want to talk quickly about the specifics of the various scams that they use throughout the movie in order to create the illusion of psychic powers. Cause I think that's just fascinating from a technical standpoint. Everything in the movie is real.
Mm.
And it is as would have been done at the time and in fact is still used today. So the first thing we see is the idea of, it's called a question and answer. You write down a question on a piece of paper. The papers are all destroyed or put into a locked box. And then the psychic can then answer those questions. And it's a very simple and accurate way of presenting yourself as psychic. The problem is, of course, that you're left with evidence. You know, you have a man crouched underneath the stage in this example, writing out all of the questions onto a blackboard and, as I said, holding them up underneath the crystal ball for her to look in and see. And then from there, they go into a little bit of cold reading, which is cold. Are you familiar with cold reading?
No.
So cold reading is, they do it very briefly, but it's the backbone of most of the stuff that's done in the film. There's a great scene where Pete is, the alcoholic is reliving his past days as a mentalist and he starts presenting his pitch to Stan and he's telling him that, you know, that who knows, is it the crystal ball that gives me the powers or perhaps it just provides me a way of gazing in on myself. And wait, I see a boy running through a field across rolling hills and there's a dog by his side, a dog, yes. And Stan goes, yes, his name was Billy. And Pete admits, because everyone has a dog. And it's that idea of those statements that are so general and yet feel so specific. And that's an instant where we see that Stanton is not infallible, that he's not a genius and that he can be tricked by his own trade. And then finally they have the code.
Yes, I was going to ask you seems very sophisticated. Seems, you know, that the subtle intonations of the voice and, or is it the words that are used? I mean, how is it, how's it done?
The idea is that one member of the duo is blindfolded and the other goes out into the audience and picks up an object from someone in the crowd, holds it up and says, what is this? And they ask the question, what is this, in a variety of different ways. So they might say, what am I holding now? Or can you tell me what this is? And the various ways in which you ask the question provide information to the person on stage who's blindfolded. So if I say, what is this? It means it's a watch. If I say, what am I holding now? It means it's a pen, for example. Sidney and Leslie Piddington were famous mentalists around the time of the movie. It was in the 1940s and 50s, and they used to do a code act, do it on the radio a lot. So they travel around and do various radio stations and live performances, and at one point did their act with her on an aeroplane and him on the ground. And the idea was that it was, you know, they were committing these thoughts back and forth across the air and extraordinary. And their system of communicating has never been revealed because it was so good. So I imagine there might be some links there between the Piddingtons, or a similar couple and the great Stanton's code that he was using. Did you as a viewer, did that feel real to you? Did it feel realistic or did it feel like a sort of a movie explanation for how they were doing it?
Yes, I think so. Hence my question, which is, as you say, it's a question in the film that the film raises in itself. But it sounds like the real life example that you mentioned with the aeroplane is a case of truth being so much stranger than fiction that it would never be believable in a movie.
We always finish with the con man's dictionary. So I give you a word or a phrase from that's vaguely linked to what we've discussed, and then you have to try and figure out what it means. Since we're exposing the secrets of mentalists, I'm going to go with nail writer.
Well, I suppose it could be a technique whereby you write the question or the prompt on a fingernail, not with a nail. Obviously, there'd be OH&S issues there.
Yeah. So the idea is to be written, say, on the back of your thumbnail, and so you can have like crib notes.
Yes, it's like exam cheating techniques in matriculation.
That is extraordinarily close. It's basically you get a small, there's a variety of ways of doing it, but you get a small piece of pencil lead and wedge it under the thumbnail, and then you write down your prediction.
Ah.
So, for example, they used to use it in guess your weight stands at carnivals. They'd say, I'm going to try and guess your weight. I'm going to write down the weight. And then the person would stand on the scales and they'd sort of say, oh, what is it? Sorry, I can't read it from this angle. And they'd be looking. And while they're doing that, they're using their thumb nail to write 6-4 on the card. And at which point they can turn it around and show that the card says 64 and that they supposedly knew the weight all along. So you can use it for mind reading. You can use it for crooked carnival games. And of course, if anyone accuses you of cheating, you just need to flick the little pencil lead out of your thumb. And walk away completely clean. So I think your answer was that's very close.
No, but you operate at a level of deviousness that's way beyond me.
Well, I'm going to take that as a compliment. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, not at all. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.